Former Kansas City Police Department intelligence detective and now attorney Gary Jenkins produced four documentary films, most recently Gangland Wire. True stories of the mob skimming from the Las Vegas casinos in the 1970s. Creator of smartphone app entitled Kansas City Mob Tours. Download it now. Highly sought after speaker for college, corporate, and service organization programs. If you like what you hear, go to ganglandwire.com. Navigate to the shop page. We need you to put a hit out on our donate button. Buy the DVD Gangland Wire or download the Kansas City Mob Tour app. We must pay the studio time and Freedom of Information Act requests that we filed with the federal government. Follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/ganglandwire. Follow true crime storyteller Gary Jenkins on Twitter at Jenks Law. Please subscribe to this podcast and review the show. Gangland Wire True Crime Stories is produced at the Big Dumb Fun Show Studio 4. And now, here's Gary Jenkins.
All right, welcome back to the second episode of the KKK in Kansas City. You know, I had a meeting recently with a friend of mine who I had became friends with back then. He runs you'd call it a private off-the-books intelligence service just for right-wing activities in the United States. His name is Leonard Zeskind, and I can say that because he's, you know, kind of come up above board lately in the last few years as he's gotten older, and he wrote a book, and he's a guy that the news media always calls on for comments about the Ku Klux Klan and any right-wing white power movements that are around, because he is an expert on groups like the Covenant Sword and the Arm of the Lord that had a big farm down in the border of Missouri and Arkansas, and the National Socialist Movement and other groups like that. And it's been his life's work to investigate these right-wing groups who preach a racist and anti-Semitic message.
Is he Jewish?
I think he is. I'm sure he is. I never ask him. He's a good guy, though, and he's dedicated. And give him a little plug. If you're interested in this, he wrote probably the definitive academic book on the modern white power movement and anti-Semitic movement, and it's titled Blood and Politics, The History of the White Nationalist Movement from the Margins to the Mainstream. And I think it's an important book today because I see people posting things on Facebook that are kind of anti-Obama and are making comments about problems in the city. Like if you want to go to the Ask Tony blog and read some of those comments whenever he makes some comment, has a story about problems with the young black kids on the plaza, why, it's pretty scary what people are saying out there and how they view black folks. So, from the margins to the mainstream, it's something that we always need to watch, is organized racist movements.
And that was what Leonard Zeskind was doing.
That's what he still does. He does to this day, and he did it back then. He's done it since about 1976. Leonard is just an intelligence gatherer, and he gathers papers and keeps track of people and documents who they are and how they're connected and keeps those files and folders, and he maintains a secret operation. And when I tried to get a hold of him most recently, he made me call him, and then he made me meet him at a certain address that was close to his place. And then we look all around to make sure there wasn't anybody out there and watching us, and then he took me into his location. And when this whole thing came up, everybody was looking to Leonard in the liberal movement looking to Leonard saying, you know, what's the deal? What's going on? Who are these people? Who is this Dennis Mahan? Nobody ever really heard of him before. And actually, in the police department, we'd hardly heard of him. We knew there's a Klan guy out there, and he worked at TWA, and his name was Mahan. And that's about the extent of what we knew about him, because we didn't really focus that much on. There hadn't been any real need to it, other than just in general and maybe clipping newspaper clippings if he came into the news. So Leonard,
but there weren't any violent acts.
There hadn't been any violent acts that we know of, and there hadn't even been any public acts that we know of. And whoever burned that cross on Emmanuel Cleaver's lawn, you know, nobody ever took credit for it that I remember. Certainly wasn't a Klan. Because Leonard monitors these groups and because he paid a lot of attention to Kansas City, he knew a lot about Dennis Mahan and his twin brother, Alan Mahan, and he knew that they had a little organization. He actually knew two or three of the names that were involved by then. Because here's one thing he had already done. He had developed a source who was now a member of the Missouri White Knights of the Ku Klux Klan and met with these guys.
Well, the Klan probably knows who he is.
They know who he is. They all know. All the people nationwide, they know Leonard Zeskind, and they hate him. They hate him. That's why he takes a lot of precautions in where he lives and when he moves around and all that, because they hate him. Much as they do Morris Deese, and they actually had a murder contract down on Morris Deese, the lawyer from the Southern Poverty Law Center that got exposed here a few years ago. And this, he had developed a source, and this was a guy who had gotten out of prison, so he was a real deal criminal. And actually, Leonard said he thinks the guy wanted to write a book because he knew about one of the turncoats in this group out west called the Order. They'd all gotten caught in these bank robberies, and so one of them became a government witness and ratted him out and then was writing a book. And so this guy, he saw that as his future, to go in and get undercover with the Klan and then write a book about his experiences. Now, he never did get the book written, but he did get in with the local Klan, and he was in really tight with them. And so he was feeding back to Leonard everything that they were doing as they prepared for this
for a rally?
Cable TV show.
Oh, yeah.
They're planning this cable TV show. So I'd gotten a hold of Leonard by then, and he didn't even tell me he has his source, and we kind of he starts feeding me little clues because he didn't want anybody to know he had this source. And if the source is gone today, the source is, you know, who knows, he's in the wind, he's long gone, and nobody knows where he is now. And so we can talk about it now, 30 years later.
You're not actually naming the name of the source.
Not naming the name. Leonard really. It was hard for him to keep this guy in money. He didn't have enough money to continue to keep him. So he got with the ATF, and the ATF took over the financing of this guy because they saw how valuable he could be. And Leonard continued to run him, and what we call by run him, you know what that means, don't you? If you run a source, he's the guy that goes and meets with him.
You're the contact.
He's the contact, and ATF provides the money. So he's giving him money from the ATF, and the guy's reporting back. And so he starts reporting back about this TV show. So Leonard reports back to the ATF, and then the ATF goes to us at the intelligence unit and says, okay, here's what's going on, and they're getting ready, and they're going to start practicing down there. You have to train for, I think it was like one night a week for 6 weeks in order to learn how to run the board.
The equipment,
the camera and all that. So... And what was funny, another little aside that Leonard just told me, is at the time when they first started this, they had at the technical high school over there at Truman Road in Paseo. Do they still call it Manual? I can't remember. It's a great big technical high school there, Kansas City High School. It's on a primarily black neighborhood. Well, it was a 100% black neighborhood, actually. It's almost a Truman Paseo. Well, they were going to use a...
They have a student film facility there,
TV studio. Right, they're the ones that built that. And for their public access, well, they didn't want these Klan people coming down to the black community wearing the robes to practice, you know, for 6 nights because it's going to be trouble. And so they rented a space, American Cablevision rented a special space at 20th and Main, and made it into a TV studio. Made it in, had to put their soundboard in the camera just for these guys. Otherwise, they'd have left it over there. So these guys start showing up, and what they have, the way they did that was I want to say it was Tuesday nights from 7 till 9, I think. I'm pretty sure that's 2 hours of training, one night a week. And so I would just send one of my detectives over there. I was a sergeant at the time, and I had 12 detectives, and I would just send a different detective over each time to act like they were training for another show because there were other people who were training at the same time, and just to start monitoring, we'd sit outside, and then they'd be inside, and then they'd radio, or they'd go back out and radio and say, okay, here's what they look like. Here's what the Klan guys look like. When they'd come back out, we'd follow them to their car, and we'd get their license number, and we start identifying who was who. And
you could pull their information once you got their license.
And I remember one night, one of my undercovers, is a woman, Renee, she was sitting in the kind of a waiting area, and there was a hard plastic bench there, and the guy had been running the camera. He sat down, and we sat down. He clunked, and he clunked loud. And there's only one thing that clunk could have been. He had a gun in his belt, and it banged against the bench when he sat down. But, you know, we knew he was carrying a gun to the training, but it just wasn't time. We didn't want to tip our hand because our sources through the
ATF. Well, you couldn't really arrest him for anything at that point except having a...
We could arrest him for CCW, and it would have blown the thing out of the water, actually. Yeah. They would have said, no, well, you can't do it anymore. I knew that would blow him out of the water. Yeah. If they caught one of their guys with a gun, they just say no.
When you say CCW, carrying
a concealed weapon, right.
Carrying a concealed weapon.
The thing that you can do without a license today. I don't know if there is a CCW.
But they potentially could have had a license to carry a concealed weapon.
Not then. No? Not in Kansas City. They wouldn't have had one then. There's nobody could have a gun stuck in their belt except a police officer back in the 80s.
Well, were you really trying to stop them from having the TV show, or are you really just trying to kind of be able to figure out who they were?
We were, yeah.
And gather intelligence on them.
Good question, Aaron, because, you know, we don't really want, you know, the court order says, you know, governments can't inhibit free speech, and that's why the court made American Cablevision have the show. And so, you know, as a police department, we're a governmental agency. We're not there to prevent them from having the show. We wouldn't mind them preventing them from having the show, but we weren't there to do that. We were there to find out who they were, because they're a group that's advocated, you know, violent activity against another group of people, the Ku Klux Klan. So we felt we were perfectly within our rights. They probably would have argued with us and probably would have sued us if they'd figured all this out, but they never figured it out. So all's well that ends well. No harm, no foul, as we say.
Well, but they had to go through these series
of
classes
training,
if you will. Once they got done, then they would probably be slated for a time to produce their original program.
Correct. That was the deal, is everybody, our source through Leonard to the ATF back to us, is saying everybody's going to be here the night they have the show. Everybody, and a lot of people from out of state. It's going to be a big deal. So that's why we don't want to tip our hand. We want to have them do the big show, and then we're going to have enough power.
You'll be able to identify additional people.
We will have enough people there of our own to identify everybody. And we didn't have an exact plan for that night, but we had kind of a plan. We'll talk about that later, probably in the next show. Actually, we're getting close to it. And I want to tell you just a little bit about the skinhead movement, because we had one kid in Kansas City that came on our radar who was kind of a wannabe racist skinhead. But this thing was getting big in the East Coast and the West Coast, and they had beaten up and injured really bad a number of African Americans and immigrants too. If there was no African American community where they were, like in Portland, I think that's where that was, in Portland, that wasn't an African kid. That was like a Thai kid or some kind of an Asian kid. But they were really conducting violent activities against immigrant populations throughout the United States, and they had this music and you know, they all dressed in a certain way. They were young. They wore the tight blue jeans and a black T-shirt and shaved heads and earrings and the Doc Martin boots.
But the actual skinhead movement didn't start in the U.S., did it?
No, it started. You know, you're a good point, Aaron. It started in England in the 70s, and it was really there was the mods and the rockers and then the skins came out of that, and it was really a music, and they formed together. They liked the style, the shaved head look, and the Doc Martens and the tight jeans T-shirts and army coats. They liked that style, and at the time they liked reggae music or ska music, and they weren't really a racist deal, but for some reason in the lower class young, unemployed white men in England, they started moving into this racist thing, and that pretty soon skipped over to the United States. And they were, I guess, they were big in Tennessee. There was a large group of them down in Oklahoma. We didn't have any real homegrown skins in Kansas City. But we did have some come in out of Oklahoma. That's why I kind of want to tell you a little bit about
and
it.
And that was in the 70s?
They started in the 70s and jumped over to the United States in the 80s and then started getting together by having these rock fests. So I got a file in there called Hammer. That's one of their main groups. Why don't you play a little bit of their music there, Aaron? I think fair use allows us, if we're making political commentary and on a piece of copyrighted material, we can play it.
Not just skinners, but we're hammer skins. We'll never lose and we always win. Not just skinners, but we're hammer skins. We'll be around when the rest give in. Not just skinners, but we're hammer skins. We'll never lose and we always win. Not just skinners, but we're hammer skins. We'll be around when the rest give in.
An enemy of the hammers, that could be fatal.
Well, thanks, Aaron. That if you want to be an enemy of the hammers, that could be fatal. And they were very violent groups, and these their music was violent. I'll play another.
Their music
piece
promoted
of
violence.
Promoted violence. And for example, I didn't really find a clip. I've got another clip with some. I think the title of it's called White Power. But for example, some of the comments on the excerpts on YouTube were under music like this is. For example, there's only one reason that coloreds hate whites, and that's they do not understand God's law. They think they are equal to whites, and they are not. It's only a problem when coloreds think they could be white. Another comment was, the blacks target us all the time. The blacks get some drugs in them, booze, and then some white man or woman will be beaten and raped. Final comments, I'm so proud of being white, I'm going to kill all the niggas and all mixed people and all gays because Hitler is my dad. And one night he came to my dreams and after fuck my ass, he told me to do stuff against no whites. Heil Sig 88, Heil Hitler, niggas are faggots, Heil Hitler, Aryan power, let's kill and kill. And some of these are a little bit tame for some of the others.
And this is actually like lyrics from the songs.
Well, they had lyrics like this in some of their other songs. These were comments underneath this song in YouTube.
Oh, okay.
And a lot of, I noticed some other things they would do is 1488. That people would just comment 14/88. And I thought, what the hell does that mean? So I go in and, you can get anything out of Google. And 14 stands for these 14 words. We must secure the existence of our people and a future for white children. And then the 88 after the 14 is 14/88. And those 88 words are for certain words in Volume 1, Chapter 8 of Mein Kampf. And I won't go all the way into this, but it's from Mein Kampf. And it talks about the purity of our blood and the freedom and independence of the fatherland. And so that's what kind of people are dealing with, these skinheads. And that's the kind of people that Dennis Mahan and the Missouri Knights and Oklahoma Knights of the Ku Klux Klan were recruiting and wanted, as we found out. We didn't know this at the time. We found out when they ran the show that's who they were recruiting.
So the program that they were developing really was about recruiting people into their organization, or they recruited those people...
It was the new media. It was cable TV. It's like today they're using the internet and they're using bulletin boards. And I didn't really get into it, but I'm sure there's probably some kind of a white power app out there and texting and Twittering and Facebook, white power Facebooking. And so they're always wanting to connect in order to get more supporters, let people know where you are. And there's going to be a guy that shows up, and we had never heard of him before. And there are these white power concerts, and Dennis Mahan connects up with a guy named Joe Greco. And I think this Rahowe, it's an acronym for Racist Holy War, was down there at the time. And this white power music, for you music aficionados, was kind of mushrooming throughout the United States. And the worst lyrics, I think, were like, you kill all the niggers and you gas all the Jews. They were lyrics from Rahowe. And that was short for a well-known racist slogan, Racial Holy War. Another lyric was "Kill a gypsy and a commie too. You just killed a kike. Don't it feel right? Goodness gracious, Third Reich." These people were bad. I got a little piece in there from Rahoa. You want to play that, Aaron?
That was actually on YouTube?
Yeah.
You found that?
Yeah.
And YouTube allows it to stay up?
Yeah. I guess it's freedom of speech.
Even though it's not a hate crime.
White People Awake. White People Awake is the name of that piece. So, and there's worse. There's actually much worse out there. I read you some of those lyrics.
Mm-hmm.
You know, kill a gypsy and a commie too. You just killed a kike. Don't it feel right? Goodness gracious, Third Reich. Those lyrics are, they're up there. That Race and Reason shows, they were all on YouTube. You got everything on YouTube. But you know, Aaron, you know a lot about music and power of music to sway people. It's a powerful tool. It's a powerful tool to use. And these guys were using it, especially for young people.
Were they trying to reach out to these disaffected youth?
Correct. That's exactly the kids that didn't connect anywhere else. The kids that you read about that go and kill a bunch of people in the school because they've been whacked around and they feel threatened by everybody. I'm not a sociologist or a psychologist, so I'm struggling with words to describe them, but they're just, other than the kids that they talk about that go out and do these school shootings today, are the kind of kids they were after. The kids that are drawn to gangs, the kids that feel they have no power and they can be bigger, a part of something that's bigger themselves and have power and feel like they've got somebody to protect them. We saw that.
Well, but there were people, if you will, out there that were, I want to say, if they were, say they were skinheads, but they were punkers.
Right.
That weren't necessarily there for the racial element of that movement.
Correct. This was just, they adopted the punk rock style, as you heard it, the kind of head-banging punk rock style of music. They adopted that because it resonated with the 20-somethings, that late teens and early 20-somethings. That beat resonated with them, and they just put their own lyrics into it. And they had big concerts with several different groups during this time in the late 80s and early 90s. I don't hear them today. I don't know if they're still doing that today. I kind of doubt it. A lot of that's changed. But you know, I read this one study and said that music is well known to connect deeply with adolescents and to influence identity development, perhaps more than any other entertainment medium. And I think back to the music of my childhood, or not childhood, but my youth. You know, mm-hmm. that still resonates with me today. And so, it was a powerful movement. I'm just glad it seemed to have died out.
There's a way for them to reach out. But people that you're talking about here in Kansas City,
they were reaching out to these young people, you know, that were attracted to this music and to the movement, to be the young blood and the next generation of the Ku Klux Klan. Only they just use different names, you know. Mm-hmm. Now they use, you know, White Aryan Resistance and Nationalist Socialist Parties and names like that. Hell, these young kids, they didn't even know what a Nazi was at this point in time. They just think it's some cool old thing from the past. But anyhow, so let's close it down for now. And next week, I will describe the night that they filmed the show, and it got pretty exciting for a lot of people.